Hello, and welcome to the history of Alexander the Great. Episode 4. First Strike. In our last episode, we looked at Alexander's personality and brought the narrative up to the invasion of Persia. Now, for the invasion of Persia. We left Alexander having just crushed the revolts of Thebes and Athens in September 335 BC. Alexander made his way up through Greece back into Macedon during the winter, where several omens are said to have occurred. Alexander went to Delphi, the site of the famous Oracle of Apollo. Some of you may be familiar with how an oracle works, but for those of you not in the know, they drugged up a priestess by making her smell crazy gases, then noted down her ramblings, and the priests interpreted this as a message from the gods. They could only do this on one day a month, and when Alexander showed up, wanting to consult the oracle about the invasion of Persia, it wasn't the correct day. When the oracle explained that she couldn't give a response, Alexander, always the gentleman, tried dragging her himself to the shrine. Eventually, the oracle exclaimed, "You are invincible, my son." Alexander was happy with this and let the poor woman be. Another omen was that a statue of Orpheus, made from cypress wood, was sweating. Most were alarmed by this, but Aristander, who you'll remember correctly prophesied the birth of Alexander, said that this meant Alexander would do deeds which would be praised for a long time and cause poets and musicians much sweat and toil to celebrate. The statue sweating was caused by condensation, so it's reasonable to say that it actually happened. Similar cases are frequently mentioned in classical literature. Now that Alexander obviously had the support of the gods, it was time to go out a-conquering. As the campaign season started, in early spring, 334 BC, Alexander made his way toward the Hellespont, which is what we today call the Dardanelles. It is one of the crossing points between Europe and Asia in northwestern Turkey, the other being the Bosphorus, which is slightly to the northeast, and the location of modern-day Istanbul. I have posted a map of Alexander's early campaigns at thehistoryofpodcast.blogspot.com, so you can follow along on Alexander's journey. His force was about 30,000 infantry with 5,000 cavalry. There were also about 13,000 troops which made up the advanced guard, who had already crossed the Hellespont, giving Alexander a total force of about 43,000 infantry and 5,000 cavalry, although these figures are disputed. It wasn't just the army that Alexander had with him. For Alexander, this was as much of an adventure as it was a military conquest. He took with him many professionals to explore as much as he could, taking geographers, historians, astronomers, zoologists, etc. Alexander needed to attack quickly, as he was in deep economic trouble. Aristobulus, who is one of the authorities for both Arrian and Plutarch, says that Alexander had 70 talents worth of funds for the army, and another that Alexander was in 200 talents of debt. There is no way that we can accurately convert ancient currencies into modern denominations, so I'm just going to say that Alexander was in trouble. Most of this debt had come from Philip, admittedly, but still, it was bad. Added to this, Alexander only had enough food for 30 days. Even though things were bad, he insisted on giving his Macedonian states away to his friends and those in the army. Although this was seen as a sign of generosity, it is also a hint that he wasn't planning to return. He did, though, ensure that there was someone in Macedonia to look after his interests there, by leaving Antipater there as regent. Parmenio had been tasked with transporting the army across the Hellespont, and 160 triremes and a large number of merchant ships had been assembled to do the deed. The army got on its boats and made its way across. When the boats approached land, Alexander threw a spear onto the land, symbolising that Alexander was claiming Asia by force. The first stop in Asia was Troy. No doubt, Alexander was drawn there by the legacy of his hero, Achilles. Alexander went to the grave of Achilles and anointed the column which marked his grave with oil, and then he had a race around it, naked, with his companions. As you do. Alexander saw the sights while in Troy, and became quite depressed. He said Achilles was lucky to have Homer to glorify him forever, while Alexander didn't have anyone to glorify him. This is the reason Arrian gives for writing his book, that he wants his book to do this, to be the book that people tie to Alexander, just as Homer has been tied to Achilles, and that this will make his book the greatest in Greek literature. I find this quite charming. Alexander had a good start in Asia, taking control of the surrounding towns, but he was not unchallenged. A group of Persian generals and governors had gathered at the town of Zalilia, including the Greek mercenary Memnon of Rhodes, who was now part of the Persian ruling class. The Macedonians had the advantage of numbers, so Memnon argued against battle, supporting instead scorched earth tactics. Well aware that the Macedonians were short of both money and supplies, it was best to wait it out and let them starve. The Persian governors, however, rejected this idea. There was no way they were going to destroy their people's possessions, and they were also suspicious of Memnon for his connections to Darius, thinking that this would cause him to delay the start of hostilities. While they were debating, Alexander was approaching, and the two forces would meet at the river Granicus. There is, of course, confusion over what happened, with the ancient sources offering two accounts. First is the account offered by Arrian and Plutarch. As the Macedonians arrived at the battle site, they found the Persians on the far side of the river. Parmenio realised that to attack would be dangerous. They would have to cross in loose column formations, which would be vulnerable to an enemy cavalry charge. Such an event so early on would be a disaster for the expedition. The best option would be, therefore, to stay on this side of the river for the night. Then, either the enemy would be nervous, as they were outnumbered, and withdraw, allowing the army to cross unharassed the next day. If the Persians did not withdraw, then they could cross upstream overnight and surprise them in the morning. Alexander rejected this notion out of hand, saying that the Hellespont would be embarrassed if he was stopped by this mere trickle. To hesitate would show weakness and give the outnumbered Persians courage. Alexander ordered the troops into battle stations, Alexander taking control of the Macedonian right and Parmenio the Macedonian left. The phalanx was in the centre of the Macedonian line with cavalry on either side. Alexander had the companion cavalry with him on the right. Arrian says that the Persians had 20,000 cavalry and 20,000 infantry, but modern estimates have put this at about 10,000 cavalry and 5,000 infantry, including many Greek mercenaries. The Persians placed their cavalry in front with their infantry behind, with more troops towards the Persian left, where they expected an attack from Alexander. The battle began with a movement on the Macedonian left. The light infantry and the cavalry feinted a charge, causing the Persians to reinforce their right. Then Alexander and the companions charged into the Persian left. There was a fierce battle around Alexander, but he was able to gain the upper hand. Alexander went into battle with two white plumes on his helmet, and was therefore quite easy to spot out. several Persians then charged at Alexander. Rosicrucius sliced off part of Alexander's helmet, and Splithridates very nearly killed him, but Clitus was able to kill Splithridates first, slicing off his arm. Clitus was the commander of the royal squadron of the Companion Cavalry, nicknamed Clitus the Black, to differentiate from Clitus the White, who was an infantry commander. While this was happening, a general advance occurred. Alexander and the right wing, then having taken control of that area of the battlefield, began moving along the Persian line, attacking the cavalry, which was engaged with the Macedonian infantry. A hole then appeared in the Persian line, and the Macedonians charged through it, engaging the Persian infantry, who were of very poor quality. The Persian cavalry and infantry then, with most of their leaders dead, routed. The Greek mercenaries were left behind, abandoned by the Persians. They appealed to Alexander for a ceasefire. Alexander declined, and ordered his infantry to massacre the mercenaries. Modern estimates are that about 300 to 400 Macedonians were killed, and anywhere between 1,100 and 4,500 wounded. 3,000 cavalry and 1,000 infantry were the Persians dead, with 2,000 wounded. That, I repeat, is the account of Arrian and Plutarch. But there is an alternative account, offered by Diodorus. This account goes that the Persians were waiting for the Macedonians to cross, so Alexander listened to Parmenio's advice and crossed upstream at dawn the next day, where the same deployments and events now happened, but next to the river rather than on either side of it. There have been attempts by revisionist historians to combine the two accounts. Peter Green offers a version where the riverbank was guarded by the infantry, and they forced Alexander back on the first day. Alexander listened to Parmenio and crossed upstream, but the Persians got word of what was happening, and the cavalry arrived before the slower infantry. Then Plutarch and Arrian's accounts occur. I think this is a reasonable interpretation, but I don't know what happened. Either way, Alexander won the battle, and the effect was huge. Firstly, there was the immediate economic advantage. Alexander, when he set off, was, in a word, broke. There weren't huge spoils that the Macedonians took, but they were wealthy enough for Alexander to send 300 shields, captured from the Persians, back to Athens, along with all the spoils. Over these was the inscription, "Alexander, the son of Philip, and all the Greeks, with the exception of the Spartans, won these spoils of war from the barbarians who dwell in Asia." This shows how distinct Sparta was becoming to the rest of Greece. And as you will soon see, Spartan Rebellion is coming to a podcast near you. Funnily enough, the one you're listening to. Alexander sent the rest of the spoils to his mother. Aww. This wasn't the biggest effect, though. Some of you may be familiar with the snowball effect. For those of you who aren't, it's describing a snowball. If you roll a snowball down a hill covered in snow, the snowball will pick up the snow and become bigger, which will make the snowball pick up even more snow. This is a very easy way of building snowmen, but more importantly, by winning at the Granicus, Alexander's support began to increase exponentially, like the growth of the snowball. Those of you who remember when I was talking about the Ionian Greek cities up and down the western coast of Asia Minor will remember that I said they hated, I repeat hated, Persian rule. They saw Alexander as their liberator, and most cities immediately threw open their gates to the Macedonians. Even the city of Sardis, which was the most powerful city on the Asiatic coast, and the location of the treasury for that region, surrendered, followed by Ephesus. In fact, every city apart from Halicarnassus and Miletus surrendered. Alexander made his way to Miletus, and placed his fleet of 160 ships nearby, commanded by the son of Parmenio, Nicanor. 400 Persian ships arrived, and Parmenio wanted to attack the fleet, because an eagle had been seen near Alexander's ships. Rarely, though, Alexander was restrained, and didn't attack, instead deciding that the sea battle could be won from the land. Alexander attacked the city, and while the Miletians were defending themselves, ordered Nicanor to attack through the harbour. The Miletians were overwhelmed, and he took the city. The Persian fleet tried to destroy Alexander's, but failed at this. Alexander then decided to disband his fleet. The Persians were completely dominant on the sea, and there was no way he was going to have a decisive victory in a naval battle. He instead pursued a policy of defeating the Persians at sea, from land. The Persians were there, on the sea, and there was nothing Alexander could do about that. He therefore didn't want to advance into the heartland of the Persian Empire, as the fleet and other Persians on land could cut off his supplies and leave him vulnerable. So he couldn't go straight into attacking Persia, and going after their king, Darius. He needed control of the Mediterranean. This was his idea. He would defeat the fleet by taking control of all their ports on the Mediterranean, and only then attacking the Persian heartland. Join us next time, when Alexander will put his plan into action and begin conquering the sea from the land. We'll cover the siege of Halicarnassus and work our way through Asia Minor with Alexander, as well as introduce Alexander's foe in these early years, Darius, King of Kings. Remember, the fun doesn't end here. You can find us online at thehistoryofpodcast.blogspot.com, which I've recently updated, adding a new feature. You'll have to visit the website to find out what it is. You can like us on Facebook at The History of Podcast Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, which is where I'm most active, both with things to do with the podcast and other things non-podcast related. Thank you to Peter John Ross for the music, and thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the programme.